Welcome to the Boss Up Podcast, episode 377. I'm your host, Emily Aries, the founder and CEO of Boss Up. And today I'm thrilled to be sitting down with Deepa Purushottaman. Deepa is a former senior executive and a corporate inclusion visionary. She challenges and redefines the status quo of leadership, success, and power by centering the experiences of women of color. As a senior partner at Deloitte, Deepa spent more than 20 years helping her clients grow and also served as the U.S. managing partner of WIN, Deloitte's renowned women's initiative. She was the first Indian American woman and one of the youngest people to make partner in the firm's history. In 2020, Deepa left Deloitte to co-found N-Formation, a membership-based community for professional women of color. Today, we're sitting down together to talk through her debut book, The First, The Few, The Only, How Women of Color Can Redefine Power in Corporate America. Deepa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm so delighted to be chatting with you. I've got a copy of your book, The First, The Few, The Only, right here in my hands, How Women of Color Can Redefine Power in Corporate America. And I'm really excited to dive into some of the theories and the research and also just the practical strategies that you map out in here. As a former political organizer, I love your approach to power. And so I cannot wait to just geek out with you about power here for a moment.
We have similar, I'm guessing, a little bit of similar background or, how we approach it.
I think so. Yeah, I'm intrigued to learn more about that. So tell me first how you decided to make this move for yourself. Like, what inspired you to write this book and, frankly, to kind of throw a curveball into your career by doing so?
Yeah. So my story is I went to grad school, decades ago, thinking I would do politics and policy. That was my background, which is why I think you and I probably have some shared philosophies. I wanted a year or two of private sector experience because I was working in DC and there was a lot of, right, you need a little bit of private sector experience or you have to pay your dues. It's a very different sort of philosophy, I think, than corporate spaces.
Yeah.
And so I thought I'll do a year or two and then, I will go back. And 21 years later, I was still in my corporate job, still at the same company, which is, I know, very unusual.
Wow.
And so it was a really interesting situation. I decided to leave for probably two things that came to a head. Mm-hmm. One was this growing question around purpose because of everything that was happening in the country. My background, I was kind of just this growing question, like, what am I doing? Like, I didn't expect to be here for two decades. Am I doing my life's work? Am I contributing? They were just really growing questions. Am I living my purpose?
Yeah.
Had a big job, right? I was a partner at Deloitte, had a big job, but just really just questioning that. And so that was kind of always there in the background for the last few years before I left. Mm. And then all of a sudden I started to get sick. I was on a big project. It started as small symptoms, right? Skin rashes, hives. And then over the course of like 2-3 years, I started to get really, really sick. Mm. I tell a story in the book where it was my 14th doctor. I was in her office. She was a doctor I saw when I traveled because I literally lived on a plane for my job. And she looks at me as she spreads all my tests across her desk and she says, I can run more tests. Or I can tell you what you probably already know. Your job is killing you. And then she asked me these three profound questions that I think were in a lot of ways were life changing. She said, do you have to do a job like this to feel worthy? You know, what is another job you could do basically?
Wow.
And don't you just see you're worthy being you? And I just kind of stopped in my tracks. And I say in the book, like, I tried to will myself not to cry because I felt totally seen, but seen through in a lot of ways.
Wow.
Work had been my entire identity. And I think it had caught up to me. So that kind of, just to fast forward the story, I allowed myself to really consider leaving. I had known for a while, right, with this purpose question. It still took me 2 or 3 years to leave. And that's a lot of what the book is about. I was a first. I was the first Indian American woman that made partner in a large firm. I felt like there were a lot of eyes on me. I felt like my leaving was not only my own failure, but failure for other women. And so a very long story short is I started gathering women of color, just in an attempt to figure out, like, where does one go after two decades? I don't even know what's possible. You get a lot of flack when you're a consultant, like, that you can't go get a real job, right? So I just started meeting with women of color, like, where do I go? What do I want to do?
Yeah.
And those turned into about a dozen dinners across the country, where I ended up meeting 300 senior women of color in an attempt just to network. But instead, what I found is the book and, the company and my calling. Like, in the first meeting, I thought we'll meet for an hour or two. We ended up spending 6, 7, 8 hours in some cases in these dinners.
Wow.
And this public company CFO, a Black woman, said, I sit in a seat of power and I don't feel powerful.
Yeah.
And that was like, again, second like life-changing, you know, moment. And so that became what I wanted to study, what I wanted to research. So that's a very long answer to like, that's really what prompted the book. Because I mean, for me, it was sickness and illness. Like that's how I lost my power. But for a lot of the women I meet, and I interviewed 500 in writing the book and now have worked with thousands, it comes in different forms, right? It comes in losing your voice. It comes in not feeling whole. It comes in hiding parts of yourself, right? Like not feeling you have enough time for your family. So it's different for different people.
Right.
But that is such a great statement for it that I think encompasses, by the way, what a lot of women are feeling in this moment. Not just
Oh, absolutely. People. And I think it's very clear to me in reading your work that you are chasing purpose here, because the sort of the approach that you take to this is one of such like intellectual curiosity and genuine. I think I can share your lens as a public policy person, or at least one with that background and grounding, like, okay, how do we solve for these systemic issues but are talking with individuals to do so? And so when you say that some of the senior women you spoke with felt powerful and powerless at the same time, I was struck really by this one quote in your book. I think is an important place to start, because I think at some point women listening to this podcast think maybe at the next promotion I'll feel powerful. Maybe at that next promotion I'll feel powerful. And you write, quote, "Women of color get pushed and pulled at each step on the corporate ladder. Entry-level WSC are trying to learn how to fit in and adapt to their job and company, and they do not always have the power to make their voices heard." Very relevant, very relatable for so many listening. You go on to say, "Mid-level women of color are caught wanting to grow and make a difference, but they can become jaded by the lack of change they're able to inspire. And senior-level women of color are often the loneliest and the most embedded in their companies with the most pressure to conform." So you really kind of project this landscape where it doesn't get much better the higher you rise. So what did you hear from women at every step of the corporate ladder?
I love that you pulled it out. I mean, to be honest with you, that's the quote you pulled out. Because to me, like, what's the most startling aspect of the book is this idea that once you're in the seat, right, the highest levels, there's more pressure to conform.
Right.
Obviously, people, there's a lot in the book, so you can take what you want from it. But to me, that's the most startling, because I was sitting in one of those seats and like finding my health really, you know, not there for me. And so I think that's such the problem. We have been taught like sacrifice, right? And this is, I just recently did a HBR piece. It's called around maladaptations, about how women conform, right? Or how women give up parts of themselves, believing certain philosophies. And one of these philosophies is that we have to sacrifice ourselves, right? So, you know, you're kind of sitting in the seat or thinking at the next step or the next rung, at some point it'll get better. And we've bought into that. And so much of what I'm talking about is that these delusions, these things we believe that we've been taught about how we work, don't actually work for us. And I would say what's so fascinating to me is I've done a big book tour. I've done all of that. It's not just that it's landing for women of color. You know, white women come up to me and say, like, you know, 80% of what you talk about, 90% really relates to me. And even men, right,
right,
are saying, I think the next generation are saying, like, that's not how I want to work either. So I think there's something here about the things we've been taught about the workplace and this idea of like, just put up with it and it'll get better at some later point. I mean, I know the next generation doesn't believe that, but I think even our generation, my generation is like, that's not, doesn't work for me anymore.
No,
it's
absolutely
interesting. Really, really senior women I also met. So women like in their 60s, like already retired. And those women, I feel like we're looking back and they were sad. They would say things to me like, I wonder if the sacrifice was worth it. Or I wonder, I look back and like women are in the same place that they were, you know, when I entered the workforce. And is that really, was my work worth it, right? And so I really wanted to uncover that. I wanted to unpack that because that's so heavy. I don't want more of us to be in these places thinking we have to do it a certain way. Because if we don't stand up and say, this isn't working, and by the way, not working for anybody, how is it ever going to change, right? We can't keep fitting in. We can't keep molding ourselves. We can't keep editing ourselves. Like, that's not working. And it's, by the way, not working for anybody, but we don't talk about that enough. So that's really what the book is about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good reminder, and you state this in a few different ways throughout the book, but it's a good reminder that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? Like, if we design a workplace that works for women of color, then we will, in doing so, design a workplace that works better for everyone.
Yep.
However, you open your book with a really telling story about a Walter, a white guy, who doesn't feel that way, right? Who truly and genuinely feels like the more women of color rise in power and in prominence and in visibility, the fewer opportunities there are for white men. I'd be curious to hear your take on that. Yeah. And tell us about that story. What happened there?
Yeah, so I opened the book with it, like you said. Walter was a great friend of mine from grad school. We ended up making a short version of the stories. We ended up making partners around the same time. So me and my firm and him and his law firm. So we were at different schools. And someone that I really trusted. I would talk to him 5-6 times a day, like one of my best friends. And we're finally in New York celebrating our, you know, promotions, which getting to that partner process, it's like a year-long process. For him, there was a lot of hazing, it felt like. And so we're celebrating, and you know, midway through our toast, I made a comment that I was feeling a lot of pressure. I made partner during a recession, so it felt like there were a lot of extra eyes on me. There were, I think, people questioning, like, should we have promoted even before I started? Like, this is just not a great time to be promoting people. So there was that question, I think, out there. And so I said to him, I'm really worried and I'm feeling the pressure. And he stopped me mid-sentence and said, I don't really know what you're talking about. You're a twofer, was the word he used. You're a woman of color. Woman and a person of color, a woman of color, you have nothing to worry about. Like, opportunities for people like you are growing, and opportunities for people like me, and, you know, a white man, are, I'm going to have to work hard for everything that comes next, and you're going to coast by. That was kind of the summary of his statement. And a really good friend of mine. And I tell the story because for me, it's also a lot of what I think happens to us, you know, all people, when someone says something like that. I got really quiet. I went in my head. And here I am thinking, like, is this what everyone thinks? And it really cut me at the knees, because if he's a friend and thinks this, like, what do people who just see me, you know, and don't know me think? And so it was so undermining, so invalidating, and really spoke to a lot of what I would call my imposter syndrome. So it's like a really big story. We're no longer, you know, people that talk to each other a lot. And I tried to talk to him about it. But the point of the story is, that is, I think, our biggest problem to these inclusion conversations. There's an idea that the pie is set, or that the chairs at the table are set. And so if I'm going to get a seat, it's going to take one from someone else. And I think that's like how the entire system is set up. Right. And that sort of philosophy or mentality is why I think we're stuck. Right. And that's part of the mentality I think we have to change. This can't be about, like, give me or you opportunities and take them from someone else. This has to be about, the system isn't working, so can we grow the pie in a very different way, or think about doing business differently? And so that's, that's such an important thought, but also a really radical one, I think.
It absolutely is.
Again, this idea that we have to do business in this very, you know, traditional way, or this historic way, is part of what I'm questioning, because it doesn't work for most of us.
Yeah. And that's a big idea, right? And I think, you know, I think Gen Z is inspiring a lot of, like, late stage capitalism conversations over here at Bossed Up HQ. You know, and I write about, in my book, Bossed Up, the martyrdom mindset, which sounds a lot like what you're talking about, this sacrificing on a chronic level. Like, what are we asking people to really do, women in particular?
Yeah.
So what you're getting at, it sounds a lot like power theory, right? So how can we look at power with a more expansive lens? In your book, you talk about, you know, your own personal power, then communal power, and then using that communal power to drive systemic change. What's your approach when it comes to advising women of color in particular
and I think it's a question everyone should be asking, but yes, for women of color in particular. I mean, part of this is, like, one, a lot of women of color have been taught, like, when we're little girls, that we're not going to be in seats of power. We're not powerful. Again, we have to adapt and edit. We tell little white boys, right, they're going to be CEOs or tech leaders. And we tell little girls, right, that they are not necessarily powerful. We do that in school. We do that, what, you know, parents tell their little girls, that you're going to have to work harder. You're going to have to do more. And we tell little white boys they're going to be CEOs. They're going to lead companies, right? It's just different messages. So part of what I'm trying to get at is those messages start early. And if we aren't aware of them, they can limit us. But part of what also happened is I met all these women and I would ask them questions around power. They would really, like, sit back in their chair, or they would not want to talk about it. They were uncomfortable with this idea of power. And I think it comes from, and I'll be curious if you think this, but it's because we've been taught a very narrow definition of power. Most of us, at least the women I interviewed, had been taught power from, like, Machiavelli or from the 48 Rules, this very, very specific idea that power is about power over, right? Or this idea of winner take all.
Right.
And that's not the kind of power that most women, and this is true for women of color and white women, like, you know, for all women, I don't think we have that sort of relationship with power, and yet we don't have an alternative. And so what I talk about in the book is we need to figure out for ourselves, like, how we define power and how we want to show up. And that's the power of me. But in order to change structures, we need the power of we. We need to work together, because I can't change a structure on my own. I need my co-conspirators, like my allies. I don't like the word allies because it's passive, but we need our co-conspirators.
Yeah.
But I also just ask bigger questions about power. Like, why don't we believe we can change structures and institutions? Why do we look at leadership and really prize like certain qualities when there's so many more definitions of leadership and power that are accessible to us, but we just haven't learned those things? So it's really like this opening, this questioning of, again, do corporate structures or do workplaces have to be the way they are? But do we all have to aspire to that kind of power? What if that doesn't resonate with us?
Right.
What do we do?
Right.
That's really what I'm
talking about. I am struck by that because I can't help but thinking back to my days studying organizing people, power, and change, right? Under Marshall Ganz at the Kennedy School, he says, right, the difference between power over.
I took his class,
You did. Oh, my gosh. Too funny. Me too. And then power two, right? Power two. I think that, by the way, that class, I think, shapes a lot of our worldview because I've run across a few people who've also taken that class, and it just informs their work for their lifetime, myself very much included. So I think power is very sexy. I think women with power, I think women who love power, I think that's very hot. And I think power in that sense is not power to or power over others, right? But power to achieve what we want to achieve. What I found most striking in your book, which I haven't really seen people address previously in this way, is your approach to kind of parsing through those messages that women of color get early on. You have to be twice as good to get half as far. You have to see it to be it, right? And you kind of push back on that and then parse through it and take some of the wisdom you want with it. So what is your take on those truisms, right? Is it bad that Black moms tell their little girls, look, honey, you're going to have to be twice as good to go half as far? Is that narrative unhelpful, or is it a reality check that we need?
Yeah, it's a hard one. And I'm very careful on how, like, I talk about that in the book, because I you know, point out that most of us learn how to work from our parents. That's what the data and the research shows, right? And that, unfortunately, like, these amazing women that I interviewed, they're giving the same messages to their sons and daughters, you know, to their children that they got from their parents. So, and there's a chapter in the book where I talk about that. You would have thought it evolved. It's not evolving.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to be said for warning people what's coming, so they don't hit the system thinking it's completely fair or it's unbiased, and then you hit it and it doesn't show up. But I also want them to say, like, this is what's going to be expected of you.
Yeah.
But you can do it differently, and here's how to do it differently. I wish there was that and, right? So I think part of what we're finding, and I find this really around the conversation of imposter syndrome in particular, is this idea that, like, what we feel is not just ours. So the idea of imposter syndrome is most of us believe we lack confidence as women, right? It's our problem. It's an internalized issue. And what we're realizing in the conversation that's growing is, no, it's extra structural. If you're told at an early age, you know, are not going to be these things, it starts to show up in you.
Yeah. You, at some point in the book, you wrote, I just found it. I literally typed, you don't have to see it to be it, and kept that in an email. And I think there's radical power in looking at the world as it is and saying, this is not fair. This is not a meritocracy, as you make very abundantly clear. Capitalism is not a fair system, and corporate America is sure as hell not fair either.
Yep.
However, if I walk into work every day thinking I'm at a disadvantage, all the research on stereotype threat, for instance, says if you fixate on how disadvantaged and marginalized you may very well be, then you're going to have less mental faculty available, less resources available to focus on doing the job at hand or playing the politics right.
I think that's totally fair, but I also think so many of the women have never talked about the structural component. I think that's the moment we're in. And it could be that your audience is more savvy, or just the next gen, you know, the next generations, like millennials, are more aware of that. But the women I spoke to tended to skew a little bit older.
Yeah.
And I feel like they hadn't come to grips with the fact that the system was flawed, that they could change that, that there are not biases, but the system itself is set up in such a way, right? So I think they've accepted like certain people are biased, but I'm not sure that they had accepted the system's bias. And that makes the difference that I was also playing with. Whereas I think, and it's a very recent conversation, I think a post-COVID or a emergent COVID conversation, that the systems aren't fair. But I don't think we talked about that, right? We didn't talk about racism work until George Floyd's murder. Like, this is all relatively new. And so I think that's maybe the difference.
Do you also think it might have something to do with the fact that these women were in many ways succeeding in that rigged system?
Absolutely.
I almost feel like the more successful you are, the harder it is to empathize with people who aren't. You're like, what? I did it. Totally. Like, figure it out.
Yeah. I think that's real. I mean, I also think like what's so interesting, and this is like my new research that's emerging, is that most of us don't decide we're going to leave behind those beliefs until we get to our breaking point. That's what the research also shows. So we conform, we edit, we are willing to, you know, compromise in certain ways. And then something happens. So either we get divorced or we have a health issue or we don't get a job, right? So let's take like marriage, right? Like I did all the right things, like, you know, to be a great wife. And my husband still went out and did something, right? Like, it's like, I did everything right. That's the moment where it's like they have, like, they bounce against the system and they realize, or, you know, I dieted or I, you know, was really careful about my health and I still had a heart attack, right? Like, it's that moment where I've done everything I was supposed to do, quote unquote, and it still didn't work out right. And what I want us to start to do, especially as women, is like to ask those questions before we get to the breaking point. Because we wait until we get to the breaking point, it's really hard to come out of that. It takes a lot more work, right? So I think that's what's really interesting.
I find that so tricky in our line of work because we're kind of in the business of giving individuals advice. We're also in the business of reshaping systems, but via the individual actors, right? So how do you say to somebody, you know, stop buying into the system as it is? I mean, you do say that in this book, right? Stop buying into how things are and start advocating for how things should be versus, look, sometimes you got to play the cards you've been dealt as you change the game. Like, sometimes you got to play the system. So how do we tap dance on that tightrope? Like, how do we walk that fine line? Like, that is a major sort of like, what's the right word? Ethical tightrope that I feel like we're constantly tripping on.
Yeah. It's interesting. I did I was part of a workshop, like a large workshop, I guess I'll call it, seminar at Harvard in the spring. And it was this conversation with some of the leading race theorists and others in the field talking about, can you change, can you update, can you change the structure with the master's tools, right? Can the master's tools be used to update the master's house, or do you have to take it down and start over, right?
Interesting
And that's a little bit of what you're asking. Like, I mean, that's really what you're asking. And that's not a new idea, by the way. That's a you know, an older concept. But, like, to talk about in today's age is, like, really interesting. And so the chapter in the book where I talk about playing the game while you change the game, I say, like, I didn't want to write it because I wanted to be all about the system, take down the system. And there were a lot of women that would come to me and say, but you need to talk about how we navigate, right? How do we show up while we're in the system? Because we all don't have the privilege to leave. We all can't leave. And some of us need to stay, right? Like, there was so much fear among my agent initially. He's like, are you telling everyone to quit? Like, you know, and it's funny, 3 years later, I feel like everyone is quitting. That was not my message. But it's kind of like you can show up differently, right? So I think my message is not exit, but you get to decide how you show up in these structures and in these places. You get to decide for yourself how much you play the game. And I do think some of us have to play the game. And I don't think it's about being your authentic self at all ways, all times. That's not what I'm talking about either. But what I work with women, what I find is it's usually 6 to 10 things that are truly important to how they want to show up in the workplace. It's not hundreds of things, right? It's like, I want to set my boundaries around, you know, being a mom and, you know, being able to leave. I want to talk about, you know, my religion. Like, that's really important. I don't want to hide that. You know, whatever that is for them. But it's kind of figuring out those 6 to 10 things. How do you not give? How do you not, how do you not change? And maybe you're willing to, you know, work later hours or work a weekend. Like, that's not a problem for you, which for some people it is, right? So it's kind of figuring out for you, how do you define your boundaries and what does that look like? You know, I give an example in the book. It's a really simple example. When I was a new partner, I made a list of like how I wanted to show up. One of the things I wrote on the list was, like, I don't want to schedule calls on Saturday mornings. I used to have a couple of partners I worked with that would do Saturday morning calls because that was, like, not client time, right?
Yeah.
But now as a leader, I got to decide if that was something I did. Right. And so as a small example, as a single person at the time, it was like, that was such an important way that I could say, like, the weekend time is protected. It's mine. But right. we don't always think like that. And I could have just kind of said, all my predecessors held Saturday calls, so I'm going to hold a Saturday call.
Right.
So it's an example of where it can be small things, but it's how you show up, how yeah. you lead, how you make your choices that are different based on who you are and what's important.
Totally. I'm looking at the area in your book where you talk about evaluating whether you stay. And you say, you know yeah. your why behind why you're staying. Know your must-haves if you do stay. Like, no Saturday calls. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Set boundaries and don't let your job own you. And then don't lose who you are and what matters to you. And those are very straightforward, very practical, and very hard to do. Right? Easier said yeah. than done. But I think, yeah. like, quitting for your own health, your own sanity, your own purpose, whatever, doesn't change the system, to your point.
Yep.
Like, I think women of color in particular are the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs in our country.
Yep.
And I think it's because we're being yep. women of color are being driven out of corporate America. It's a brain drain that nobody's paying enough attention to. So what does it look like? Like, what's the balance here between that private sector change that we're aiming for, whether it's driven from employee demand or top down,
yep.
versus, and this is totally outside the, confines of your book yeah. necessarily, but yeah. your background in public policy, what role does the public space have in this? Like, is this a change that you actually think that corporate America can make? To back to that question around the panel that you were wow. on.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, the book was written, a year ago, right? A little bit sure. over a year ago, right? And then there's a whole book launch process. So my answer has probably changed at different points. Now, yeah. we're at a moment where I would tell you so many of the women I work with are being forced back into the office, right? They're over the summer, it felt like there was more choice. I know a lot of women where it's like 3, 4, 5 days, or you have the proximity bias if you're not in the office and not seen, right?
Yeah.
People think you're not working as hard. And so I feel like we're in a moment right now, especially, and coming maybe even into the beginning of next year, where those questions are being decided. Like, now's the moment where, are we going to revert, or are we going to take what we're learning? And I think the recent McKinsey research that suggests, like, that we are going through, that women are going through the great breakup
yeah.
is an example where the highest rates of women exiting, or, like, they're not leaving to not work. They're leaving to work differently, or to in different spaces, or start their own thing. Like, there is something that's happening. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of companies are trying to revert.
Yeah.
And I think you're starting to see what happens when that happens. And we're going to see more women just opt out and do other things. Not opt out not to work, but opt out of the structure and to choose to do it differently.
And it's hard to, like, begrudge them. You're like, yeah, girl, same, I feel ya. And so it's definitely a moment of reckoning whether companies care about that brain drain. Like, if you really care about retaining the best and the brightest and making work for those best and brightest, how much does it really matter to you if you're seeing a mass exodus of women? It does terrify me a little bit, because we're seeing backsliding. And I think we're not just seeing that in the private sector, are we? We're seeing that in a lot of public spheres as well.
Yeah.
As of the recording of this episode, the midterm elections have not yet happened, just for clarity's sake.
So
I'm still holding my breath.
Your point is so valid. So, by the way, again, the book is on corporate America, but I've talked to nonprofits. I mean, I have a lot of professors that call me saying this is happening at my institution. So I do think it's happening in other sectors. There's maybe more acuteness of some of the behavior in corporate, but I think it's universal. So I don't think it's sector specific. I think these are some of the norms of how we work. And I think the way it's being handled is a conversation around burnout. But I think that is code for a lot of things that we haven't fully unpacked, right? We'll give you more wellness activities, or you can take more spa days. Like, that's not solving what we're talking about.
I am so glad you said that, because we were just talking about it this morning. We have that conversation regularly here. Should we go back to the burnout conversation? And I find that the clients who come to us looking for help with burnout are so, frankly, missing the mark. They're like almost disingenuous. They're like, well, we're not going to change the systemic problems that we have, so can you give us a 90-minute workshop on burnout? And I'm like,
yes,
I don't know if I can do that anymore. Like, I'm tired of that. It's been a decade of that. And it's just, that's not the most meaningful work we do here. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
I mean, I think a lot of people, by the way, would say the same thing about DE&I work. Like that's the same challenge, right? I get a lot of people coming to me. Can you help us like put in a program around still unconscious bias, right? Like, no. I just say no. No, I can't do that.
That's smart.
If that's what you're focused on, you have bigger issues.
You and I need to grab a cocktail sometime soon because I'd love to talk to you more about that. In the meantime, who should pick up a copy of your fabulous book? Who do you think this is most impactful for?
Yeah, I love that question. So interestingly enough, I wrote it solely for women of color. Like I don't define a lot of the language in the book. And it's actually been a lot of white male leaders in particular who bought the book originally. Because they're like, I have so many questions. And by the way, I can't ask those questions anymore because I've been told to go educate myself. And so it actually, I think, is a book for women of color to see themselves. And
sure.
Obviously now a lot of women of color have read it and I get that response. But you don't have to be a woman of color. You can be a leader, you know, an HR leader trying to understand what you can do. And I talk some of that. But you can just be a co-conspirator wanting to understand what's different. Because you can't fix it if you don't understand it. And because I have so many stories across industries, across sectors, across the country, what I'm being told is the volume of stories makes it hard to deny. Like, so I don't have just 10 stories. I have hundreds of stories.
That's awesome. I love that. Where can our listeners keep up with you, Deepa? And thank you, by the way, for sharing your time and
thank
insights.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. I would say my website, so deepapuru.com. I have, you know, list a lot of different things there. You can buy the book there. You can buy the book. It's available anywhere you buy books. There's also an audio book. But I'm most personally active on LinkedIn. So I do a lot of posting around these kinds of topics in particular. And so if these kind, you know, whether it's burnout, which I agree with you, I'm actually doing a big talk on burnout on Thursday. And it's about the system not working, not really like how you know, take a break. But that's what I would say. Those are the places to find.
Awesome. So. Thank you so much for being here, Deepa. And let's be friends. I'll drop you a line when I'm in LA next. And
I would
please do the same
Thank
if you're in
you.
Denver, because this was such a fun conversation.
Thank you.
For links to everything that Deepa and I talked about in today's episode, head to bossdev.org/episode377. That's bossdev.org/episode377. And if you want to level up your leadership in the coming year with us here at Bossed Up, enrollment is open now for our January launch of Level Up, our 6-month leadership accelerator for women on the rise. So head to bossdev.org/level up to learn more and enroll today. Until next time, let's all keep bossing in pursuit of our purpose and, might I add, power, because we love a woman who loves power. And together, let's lift as we climb.